From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we go down to Jasper, Texas, for more on the trial of the first man accused in the dragging death of African-American James Byrd. And then we'll hear original footage of the day 34 years ago yesterday when Malcolm X was assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the pressure at the Kosovo peace talks intensifies, more fighting has erupted in the embattled province. International peace verifiers say Serb police are separating men from women and children in two ethnic Albanian villages near the fighting. And a spokesman says that's obviously a bad sign. The battle is taking place north of Pristina, where Serb forces, backed by tanks, are battling the Albanian rebels. In another sign of rising tensions, two unarmed peace monitors were assaulted by two Serbian policemen in Kosovo, but were not seriously hurt. U.S. warplanes bombed Iraqi military sites today after being targeted by Iraqi radar in the northern so-called no-fly zone that's imposed by the United States and Britain, but not by the United Nations. An unspecified number of U.S. F-15s dropped 9 precision-guided bombs on Iraqi anti-aircraft artillery and radar sites near Mosul. The Germany-based U.S. European Command said this in a statement sent to the Associated Press. Mosul's 250 miles north of Baghdad. None of the planes were damaged and all returned safely to their base in Incirlik in southern Turkey. The statement said damage to the Iraqi sites was being assessed. Iraq has challenged Allied forces in the so-called no-fly zone almost daily since December and has threatened to attack Turkey, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia if the U.S. and British flights continue. Allied warplanes have barred Iraqi military flights over northern and southern Iraq since after the 1991 Persian Gulf War. This news from Rambouillet, France. At the Kosovo peace talks, Madeleine Albright has been calling NATO's Secretary General as well as officials in Russia and Albania to try to help broker a peace accord. Ethnic Albanians' demand for a vote on independence is a key sticking point one of the Serbs are using to their advantage. According to State Department spokesperson James Rubin, while Kosovo Albanians are moving forward toward a deal, Serbs aren't seriously working on their big stumbling block, allowing foreign peacekeeping troops into Kosovo. The European Union is dangling a carrot, offering to gradually lift sanctions against Yugoslavia if there's a deal. The deadline for reaching a deal is 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow. Congress gets back to business today and is expected to debate Social Security, education funding, and taxes after months of nothing but impeachment. Republicans and Democrats left Capitol Hill a week ago for the President's Day recess with high hopes of working together on legislative issues, sidelined during the impeachment debate and Senate trial that ended February 12th with President Clinton's acquittal. They returned to Washington ready to fight over ways to spend bigger than expected federal budget surpluses, how to save the nation's retirement and health care programs, and whether to cut taxes, issues that could decide control of Congress in the next election. So far, there are few areas of agreement. This news from New Haven, Connecticut. Scientists working at a secret farm somewhere in the Northeast are growing pigs whose DNA has been altered with human genes. The company developing the new pigs say they may soon be used for treating human organ failure, spinal cord injuries, and illnesses such as Parkinson's disease. But some medical experts fear viruses unique to pigs could be introduced through organ transplants, and animal rights activists say animals should not be bred for human organs. Imprisoned rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan has provided interrogators with a detailed accounting of Greek aid to his rebel group, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. This according to a Turkish newspaper today. Öcalan, captured in Kenya a week ago and taken to a Turkish prison island, is expected to stand trial for waging a 15-year war of insurrection. The national daily newspaper Hurriyet said Öcalan had acknowledged that Greece provided his guerrilla army with weapons and training, as well as a Greek Cypriot passport he used in his travels. There was no immediate response to the allegations in Greece. And the British government yesterday lost its bid to block publication of leaked extracts of a report that branded London's police force institutionally racist. The extracts were published by the Sunday Telegraph newspaper. The Labour government initially won a court order on Saturday night, stopping publication midway through the first run of the paper's early editions. But a High Court judge partially eased the ban later on Sunday, saying details that had already appeared in the public domain could be published and commented on. According to the Sunday Telegraph, the report accused the London police of pernicious and institutionalized racism, which it said was in contrast to the view of the commissioner, the Metropolitan Police Chief, Sir Paul Condon. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. There could be some gruesome testimony today in the trial of the white supremacist accused of dragging a black man to his death in Jasper, Texas. A pathologist is expected on the stand to tell how the victim was chained to a pickup truck and killed, his head and right arm found separated from the rest of his body. Jurors are also likely to see a video of the crime scene as the prosecutors move to wrap up their case today. John William King could get the death penalty if convicted by the Jasper, Texas jury. King is an ex-convict whose body is covered in racist tattoos. Witnesses have already testified King was trying to start a racist gang in Jasper before the killing. He's one of the three men charged in the dragging death of James Byrd. We're joined now by Jeremy Scahill, who's been covering the trial in Jasper, Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
So can you tell us, as you sit in the courtroom each day, we spoke to you on Friday, but then the court proceedings took place after we spoke. What has happened since then?
Well, you know, Amy, it's interesting. On this weekend, I got an opportunity to visit the crime scene that you're talking about, and I went down Martin Luther King Boulevard, where these three men, according to prosecutors, picked up James Byrd Jr., and then I went to the road where they dragged his body 3 miles. And on that road, you can still see the evidentiary circles where parts of his body were strewn across a 3-mile stretch. You know, it's interesting to note that this neighborhood is a primarily black rural neighborhood that they dragged James Byrd Jr. through, almost like they were doing it for show, to drag him through this neighborhood. And his body parts were falling off as they dragged him back and forth on this road. And eventually they left his head in front of a black cemetery and a black church. And, you know, we've gotten a chance to talk to more and more African-American residents of Jasper, and they're just outraged. They're outraged because they believe that the racism is here, that it's been here since the time of slavery and since the time of the Civil Rights Movement. And they're demanding justice in this case. And so you see an increasing presence of African-Americans here. And in fact, the hearing on Friday brought some explosive evidence that's going to make it very difficult for a jury not to convict Bill King based on the evidence. There was days worth of grueling FBI testimony and police testimony trying to go through the chain of custody of all of the evidence, linking it from one officer to the next officer, and eventually it got to its climax and they brought an FBI DNA expert to testify. That DNA expert, Frank Bechtel from the FBI, told jurors that he found blood that matched James Byrd Jr.'s on the shoes of all three defendants and in the clothes of one of King's co-defendants, Sean Barry. He also found James Byrd Jr.'s blood on the bottom of the truck as well as on the tires of that truck. And the FBI agent also testified that he found cigarettes at the scene of the crime, as well as a beer bottle that were matched. The DNA was matched to each of the defendants on the cigarettes and another of the defendants on the beer bottle. In an interesting twist, though, Amy, on one of those cigarettes, the cigarette smoked by Bill King, they also found the DNA of James Byrd Jr., which raised the specter that maybe King had given him a last smoke before they eventually killed him. Prosecutors did allude to that also in the press conference. Another thing is that they found a cigarette with Sean Barry's DNA on it. That cigarette also had a fourth person's DNA that was not James Byrd Jr. nor the other two co-defendants, raising the specter that there was a fourth person involved with the crime scene. And Guy James Gray talked about, he's the Jasper County District Attorney, he talked about the significance of that evidence, and we'll go to that cut right now. Okay, Amy?
Go ahead, do it.
All right.
You don't have to say, by the way, we'll go to that cut. People don't know the word cut.
Okay.
Just said that this is what he had to say.
they were pleased with that evidence today. There are three cigarette butts at the scene. They begin, or they're on the ground where the dragging begins. One comes back to King, one to Barry, and one to Brewer. And then there are three pair of shoes from the apartment, and all three of those have tiny flecks of Mr. Bird's blood on it. It's pretty good evidence. I think it proves these three guys did what they're charged with.
That's the Jasper County DA who's trying the case, Guy James Gray. Jeremy, what about the family? Are they in the courtroom every day?
It's interesting, Amy. The family comes in every day, and they take up about a row and a half right behind the prosecution team. And I'm sure it's been a very enormously difficult time for all of them. Mr. Bird has been in the courtroom, as well as James Bird Jr.'s daughters, and also his sister from Houston has come in, and she sort of served as the spokesperson for the family. And it was an extremely, I think, emotional and heart-dropping moment for the family when the prosecution brought out the 24-and-a-half-foot chain that they say was used to drag their family member, James Bird Jr., to his death on that road that summer night in 1998. And they brought out the chain and displayed it for the entire courtroom. And at a press conference I attended this weekend, Clara Taylor, James Bird Jr.'s sister, talked about the effect that that chain had on the family when they saw it.
It was very emotional. I personally felt pain all the way down to the deepest part of my heart. So I could imagine what it was like to have your body, to have yourself strapped and chained and dragged. It was a very painful experience.
Clara Taylor, the sister of James Bird, who was dragged to his death last summer. Jeremy Scahill with us in Jasper, Texas, at the courthouse where he's covering the trial of the first of three men who are charged with James Bird's murder. The man who's on trial right now is Bill King. Jeremy, on Thursday, the chain was displayed in the courthouse. On Friday, the brother of another of the defendants also gave some explosive testimony.
That's right, Amy. Lewis Berry testified. He's the brother of Sean Berry, one of the accused in this case. And the defense, the lawyers for Bill King, have been trying to cast some light or trying to put the case forward that Lewis Berry perhaps was a potential suspect. He did live off and on with the defendant, Bill King, at that same apartment. And they were trying to say that he possibly was someone who would have been involved with the crime. When they brought Lewis Berry to the stand, it was a remarkable moment. Lewis Berry was very obviously someone who didn't care very much for Bill King's racist beliefs. He himself plays in a band with African Americans in that band and spoke about how he confronted Bill King about his racism. He also linked the shoes to each of the defendants. There was some confusion about one pair of shoes that had the initials LB on them, which could be Lewis Berry or could be Lawrence Brewer, like one of the other defendants. He clearly testified they were Lawrence Brewer's. He identified his brother's clothing that had the blood of James Bird Jr. on it, and he identified Bill King's shoes, which they say also have James Bird's blood on it. So his testimony was very, very damaging. He also brought up the issue of Bill King's tattoos. He said that Bill King referred to one of the tattoos on his left arm as, quote, my little hanging nigger. And this was a tattoo of a black man hanging from a tree. This ongoing discussion on Bill King's tattoos, as well as some of the other evidence that they're presenting, is all intended to show the motive and intent that Bill King and his two co-defendants had the night that James Bird Jr. was murdered. And part of the reason the prosecutors keep talking about these tattoos is because they're trying to prove a kidnapping charge. In the state of Texas, in order for someone to get the death penalty in a capital murder case, they have to be proven to be committing another felony when they murder someone. They have to be convicted of two felonies. And so the prosecution today, Amy, is focusing its efforts on trying to convict Bill King not only of murder, but of kidnapping as well. And we're going to go to Jasper County District Attorney Guy James Gray.
The definition of kidnapping includes tying somebody or restricting their freedom of movement while they're alive. That's kidnapping. So we need that evidence to establish the kidnapping portion of a capital charge.
Jeremy, that's what the prosecution is trying to do. What about the defense attorneys for Bill King?
Well, Amy, now that the DNA evidence is in and the tattoos really have damaged Bill King's, particularly in the eyes of the community here in Jasper, his ship is really sinking fast. And as the prosecution wraps up its case, most likely today here in Jasper, a lot of people are wondering what possible defense Bill King's attorneys can pull together. In fact, his lawyer, Sonny Cribbs, tried to resign a few months ago because Bill King would not cooperate with him. And Cribbs and his co-counsel, Brack Jones, have also alluded to the possibility that they were going to put the judicial system itself on trial. They've been doing a lot of cross-examination of FBI witnesses and police officers, trying to raise the possibility of FBI or police misconduct or just plain mistakes. And they were also on the defensive when they were asked how they could represent a person like Bill King, and they both said that he was entitled to this sort of defense. But Sonny Cribbs, his lawyer, doesn't sound too excited or too optimistic when he talks about the prospects for his client, Bill King.
I'm not going to really comment on what we're trying to do. It's the evidence is going to be the evidence that comes in, and we're going to do our best to at least put on something that can help save this boy's life if we can.
Jeremy, I wanted to end today's discussion with any outward signs of protest or resistance that are taking place at the trial of the first man, Bill King, who's being tried for the murder of James Byrd.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Occasionally on the radio here in Jasper, they have blared out different messages to their domestic population here, some of them telling people that they can still come to the area around the courthouse, that businesses are still open, encouraging people to come out of their house. But the sheriff's department has also put out messages that people of Jasper should stay at home, should not come near this hearing at all. And part of the reason for that, authorities say, is because the Ku Klux Klan has rallied at different points since James Byrd was killed last summer, as well as the new Black Panther Party and members of the Nation of Islam. And so the only real presence here is not particularly Jasper-based. It's been from the Houston area, or it's been from outlying areas where the Ku Klux Klan is. But the residents of Jasper don't seem to be actively participating in any sort of protest, save for the few residents who do show up to shout at Bill King when he's brought out of the courtroom. But one of the leaders from the Nation of Islam, who has been very involved with this case and in fact attended a day of it, is Quanel X, a Black Muslim activist from Houston, and he spoke to reporters late last week after he left the courtroom.
Mr. Barker, if some white folks stop you in the middle of the night and you are by yourself, it's better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6. Defend yourself by any means necessary, because lynching black brothers and sisters in America is as common in this country as apple and cherry pie. They murdered this brother, they lynched this brother, and it's a damn shame what happened to him. And I pray by God's grace and permission that if they're found not guilty by some delusionary jury, I pray that we give them hell from the womb to the tomb, from the cradle to the damn grave.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Jasper, Texas, as you continue to bring us daily updates on the trial of the men charged with the murder of James Byrd. And very interesting to end on that quote of Malcolm X, as today is the day after the 34th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X in the Audubon Ballroom in New York. And so we will go back to that day 34 years ago, February 22nd, 1965. And we're going to bring you an excerpt of a video documentary called Brother Minister, The Assassination of El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, a description of that day in Harlem. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
When Malcolm came into the ballroom that Sunday, I met him in the middle aisle, and I escorted him in the back to a little office area in the back of the ballroom, which sits off to the, well, if you're the speaker, it's off to the left. And if you're facing the stage, it's off to the right. And as the rally started to form up, myself and three others were given front rostrum spots. I had the spot on the right-hand side, the same place I escorted Malcolm into, and there was three others across the across the front of the stage.
He stands in the doorway of the dressing room, listening to Benjamin 2X warm up the crowd with inspirational metaphor and promises of eternal paradise. Something feels wrong out there, he tells those around him. Then the minister quietly moves behind the rostrum, takes a seat, assembles his notes, and prepares himself to take center stage, as he has done for the past 12 long years.
I didn't see him. I was made aware that he was sitting behind me. And he had walked out of the green room. You know, I guess that's what they call it, where performers would make up and wait to come out on stage. And evidently he had laid something on a piece of paper on a chair beside him, which was slightly to my right. And when I looked down, I saw his hand reach for whatever he had laid in the chair, paper. And I guess him being very sensitive realized that I was aware that he was there. And he said, make it plain. Make it plain was, I'm ready to come forward. That's all it meant.
You're listening to an excerpt of a documentary on the assassination of Malcolm X. We're going to come back to that in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back just for a few minutes to that day 34 years ago yesterday when Malcolm X was assassinated in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. This is an excerpt of the documentary Brother Minister, The Assassination of Alhaj Malik Shabazz, produced by Jack Baxter and Jeffrey Al Muhammad.
I didn't mean to continue to talk. And I said, I now bring before you a man that would give his life for his people.
Just as Benjamin was ending his speech, the four of us was relieved. We went to the back of the ballroom. We were told to find seats in the audience and report back to the same location to relieve the other brothers that were up front. As that meeting was breaking up, Malcolm was being introduced. He came on the stage. Two individuals about four or five rows back started a commotion and get your hands out my pocket, nigga. I started walking towards them, and all of a sudden I see three individuals up front pumping shots at Malcolm. And they were moving from Malcolm's right toward the center aisle. I turned and went back toward the center aisle. Two people passed me, and that's when I met Hayer. He pointed his gun at me just as he fired, I turned sideways and hit him with the chair and knocked him down, and he got up and started scampering out.
You were listening to Gene Roberts, who is the police informant who was also a bodyguard for Malcolm X.
And I heard a voice, and I think that voice either had to be Earl Grant's or Brother Rubens. And I heard him say, "Stop that guy. He just shot Malcolm." And I turned around. I stuck my foot out. He stumbled. And I turned around and ran back down the stairs. And about 10 or 20 people pounced on him. So he wasn't going anywhere. And two police officers emerged with their guns drawn and took the crowd. They rescued this man. It turned out to be Thomas Hale. They rescued him. But my recollection tells me that there was someone else there besides Thomas Hale. I believe two men were put in the police car and taken to the police station.
I didn't really hear what Brother Benjamin said, but by the time Brother Malcolm came out, I was sitting, you know, there facing the steps. And I heard Brother Malcolm say, "Assalamu alaikum." Now, I didn't see him because, you know, this little room is kind of off the main. When you walk into the main ballroom, there's like these swinging, you know, doors, and you go into them, and then you into the main ballroom. I was in this little, so I heard him say, "Assalamu alaikum," and the next thing I heard was shots. And I mean many shots. I mean, it sounded almost like a battlefield, from the way it sounded. I got up. I ran through the doors into the main ballroom. By this time, of course, people are running out, and people are screaming, and you hear people screaming and crying, and chairs being knocked over. And so I was knocked to the floor, and I lay there, you know, covering my head. And then when much of this stopped, I jumped up. I ran down to the stage. I jumped up on the stage, and I saw him laying there. By this time, Mrs. Koshiyama had his head kind of in her lap. And someone had pulled his shirt open, and I saw all these bullet holes in his chest. And he was gasping. He was gasping for breath. He was not dead yet. He was gasping for breath.
A major moment in history, the assassination of Malcolm X 34 years ago yesterday on February 22nd, 1965. You've been listening to an excerpt of the documentary Brother Minister, The Assassination of Alhaj Malik Shabazz, produced by Jack Baxter and Jeffrey Al-Muhammad. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! What's the Jomo Kenyatta we woo? Saman free one yin sanum. Hey, a coin a bayah. What's the hofe boy we woo? Saman free one yin sanum. Saman free one yin sanum. Hey, a coin a bayah. What's the Marcus Garvey we woo? Saman free one yin sanum. Saman free one yin sanum. Hey, a coin a bayah. What's the Bob Marley we woo? Saman free one yin sanum. Saman free one yin sanum. Hey, a coin a bayah. What's the Malcolm X we woo? Saman free one yin sanum. Saman free one yin sanum. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we move on to another segment of today's program. This week, representatives from over 100 countries, from dozens of environmental organizations, and from trade and business groups have convened in Cartagena, Colombia, for the UN-sponsored World Conference on Biosafety. This may be the most crucial conference on biosafety to date, where the international rules guiding the business of bioengineered products will be set. On the one hand, countries such as the United States, Canada, Argentina, Australia, and New Zealand, large exporters of genetically engineered foods, are pressing for rules that will allow for free trade for the products and few regulations and liability for the industry. These countries are echoing the position of the industry, including biotech giant Monsanto, who say that bioengineered products are safe to eat and yield better crops because they're resistant to certain pests. Pressing for stricter rules and for further health studies are organizations such as Greenpeace, which has called for a moratorium on the production and consumption of genetically engineered foods. And representatives from developing countries are rejecting the products, saying that genetically engineered seeds endanger the future viability of agricultural communities. We go now to Cartagena, where Charles Margulis is standing by. He is Greenpeace genetic engineering specialist attending the conference. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Charles.
Hi, Amy.
Well, can you tell us exactly what is happening there now and how long the conference goes on for?
conference has been going on for a week now. It is scheduled to end tomorrow, supposedly with the signing of the protocol. Unfortunately, up to this point, the U.S. has played a major role in trying to stop any protocol from actually being put into place. The U.S. has really played the Terminator role in this conference this week. The U.S. biotech company Monsanto recently came out with a Terminator technology which sterilizes seeds so that plants can't reproduce. And the U.S. is obviously doing Monsanto's bidding here, trying to terminate this process by putting a stop to any chance of having a real biosafety protocol occur in Colombia here this week.
Can you explain what you mean by biosafety protocol?
Yes, this will be the first international agreement to protect the environment from the dangerous effects of genetically modified organisms. These are crops that are produced by biotech companies and released into the environment without adequate testing or safeguards, and that may have adverse effects that are irreversible. So as you mentioned, Greenpeace has called for a ban on the release of genetically engineered organisms into the environment. We believe that the environmental consequences could be devastating. We're talking about genetic pollution on a scale that's unprecedented in ecological history. And we feel very strongly that this protocol needs to be a strong agreement to protect the world's ecosystems from this dangerous new technology.
What are the countries that are fighting against the loosening of regulations against genetically engineered products?
Well, the United States has been joined by active involvement from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and now Uruguay and Chile have joined together with these major grain exporters. They're now calling themselves the Miami Group. They held meetings in Miami before coming to Cartagena this week, where they obviously put together a strategy to maximize the U.S. Participation in this conference. Interestingly, the United States is not a party to the protocol. The United States has not ratified the Convention on Biological Diversity, which the biosafety protocol is being negotiated under. So regardless of the outcome this week, the United States will not be a signatory to the protocol. And this is an ironic situation, given that the U.S. has the largest delegation here at the meetings, with 23 of our government's representatives here. And yet the United States will not sign the protocol. So whatever rules are established may not apply to the United States. This is obviously a very dangerous situation, since the United States is the major producer and exporter of genetically modified crops. And these are the crops that the United States and its Miami Group partners would like to see excluded from any regulations. Even if there is a weak biosafety protocol, these countries have argued that genetically engineered crops are not living organisms and therefore will not have environmental effects and should not be covered in the protocol. This is obviously a ploy to exclude the majority of products that should be covered in the protocol from any regulation. We're very hopeful that the rest of the nations of the world will see through this and insist that commodities are covered.
Who is running the conference?
The conference is run by the United Nations under the auspices of the Convention on Biological Diversity. The chair of the conference is an Austrian, but as I mentioned before, the United States has really played an influential role in the dealings, not only on the floor in the plenary sessions, but in the Miami group sessions. The United States is also active in another regional group called the JUSCANS, which includes Japan as well as U.S. and Canada, New Zealand and Australia. And the conference is really an amazing process with negotiating sessions going through the night for the past couple of nights, whereby the U.S. And two or three other countries have been called in by the chair to draft a final text for the protocol.
Well, Charles Margulis, we want to thank you for being with us, Greenpeace genetic engineering specialist attending the Cartagena, Colombia conference on biosafety. And we're going to turn now to a colleague in Britain, an unusual coalition composed of environmental activists, the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats, dissidents from the Labour Party, and Britain's Prince Charles are calling for a moratorium on the consumption of genetically engineered foods, which are known there as Frankenstein foods or Frankenfoods. They say that there's not enough research on the health effects of the products for them to be declared safe to eat. Their target is biotech giant Monsanto, main exporter of the foods, as well as Prime Minister Tony Blair, who recently said he believed that gene-altered foods were safe to eat and added he would have no hesitation in eating the products himself last week. Greenpeace activists responded to Blair's comments by dumping 4 tons of genetically engineered soybeans in front of 10 Downing Street, Blair's residence. Monsanto was recently fined 17,000 British pounds when its genetically engineered altered seeds cross-pollinated from one field onto a neighboring field and destroyed the crops there. Dr. Douglas Parr is with us, who is from Greenpeace as well. He's the campaign director for Greenpeace UK. And I should say in just a few minutes we'll be joined by Monsanto itself, which is based in St. Louis. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dr. Douglas Parr.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what this protest has been about in Britain?
There's a great deal of concern in Britain about genetically modified foods particularly, but also genetically modified crops. It comes from a concern, really, that we don't really know what we're dealing with here. A number of recent things happening in the recent past have suggested that when scientific assurances come that everything is safe and there's nothing to worry about, that hasn't always been the case. And it seems to many people who actually are looking for much safer and more natural foods that genetic engineering of them is going one step too far. We're seeing at the moment a massive growth in the interest in organic foods, and I've just been hearing that supermarkets in the UK are actually being very careful about how they lay these organic foods out on the shelf, because if they don't lay them in small packages, then they end up selling too much of it and they sell out too quickly. The supermarkets just can't get enough of organic food, and I think that's the flip side of people being very worried and concerned about genetically modified food.
Can you tell us specifically about the protests in front of Tony Blair's residence?
Yes, in that context, we felt we would take about 4 tons of genetically modified soybeans to the residence, number 10 Downing Street, of one of the few people who is left in Britain who's prepared to eat it. After Tony Blair made his intervention about a week ago to say he thought genetically modified food was fine, it does seem as though there's a very, very small number of people who are actually willing to put their hand up and say we want it. So we thought it'd be very appropriate for him to get it. And, of course, what we did at the same time was to put a basket of organic fruit on top and urge him to go organic. The particular problem for Britain is that we have one of the lowest levels of organic farming in Europe. Many European countries have much higher levels. So really it was a dual message to Tony Blair saying stop genetic engineered food and go organic.
So finally, where does genetically engineered foods and products, crops, stand in Britain right now?
At the moment, there seems to be only a very few people who are willing to support it. This seems to be the Prime Minister, a few people in the upper echelons of government, and a few people in the Lords, and of course the biotech industry. Every opinion poll, focus group, or anything else you look at says the overwhelming might of public opinion is against the use of these things, against genetically modified foods, and deep concern about genetically modified crops, with, as I say, a countervailing trend, which is that we should go for organic. So the market for these GM foods is looking very dodgy.
Well, I want to thank you for that brief explanation, Dr. Douglas Parr, campaign director for Greenpeace UK, speaking to us from London. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Jeremy Rifkin, president of the Foundation on Economic Trends, and Jay Byrne, a spokesperson for Monsanto. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Place of our birth, Can we stand aside? Watch the rape of the world. It's the beginning of the end. It's the most heinous of crimes. It's the deadliest of sins. The greatest violation of all time. Mother of us all, place of our birth, we all are witness to the rape of the world.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Biotech giant Monsanto recently made headlines for its strategy in trying to enforce the patent of its seeds. A recent Washington Post article entitled Seeds of Discourse describes the saga of Percy Schmeiser, a Canadian farmer who was recently sued by Monsanto in a landmark seed piracy case. Schmeiser is one of hundreds of farmers in the U.S. and Canada who are accused by the biotech giant of replanting the company's patented seeds in violation of a three-year company rule requiring that farmers buy fresh seeds every year. In Schmeiser's case, investigators from Monsanto went to his field and took samples of plants growing nearby his fields. They said that testing proved he was growing Monsanto seeds illegally, but Schmeiser told the Washington Post he'd never used Monsanto's gene-altered seeds and they probably cross-pollinated or blew into his field from a neighbor's plot. He and other farmers complain about the level of harassment from the company, which includes radio ads broadcasting the names of non-compliant farmers and a tip line to help farmers blow the whistle on each other. Well, Monsanto says that the tactics are necessary if they're to recover the millions of dollars that it takes to actually develop the seeds that they say help farmers and people around the world. We're joined now by Jay Byrne, spokesperson for Monsanto. Jay Byrne, you have heard a lot so far from Cartagena, a Greenpeace spokesperson, talking about the criticism of the U.S. for pushing bioengineered foods. Then we went and spoke to a Greenpeace person in Britain who was protesting bioengineered foods being brought to Britain. What are your comments so far?
Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, you had me on hold, and I could only hear your questions. I couldn't hear any of the answers. But based on your questions, there are several things I think that might be important to note. One, the biosafety treaty currently going on in Cartagena is not about loosening of regulations. It's about setting standards. And I think you'll find that life sciences companies, whether they're Monsanto or Novartis or DuPont, and by the way, Monsanto is the smallest of all the large biotech companies today, would welcome a consistent playing field across the world so that we can deliver improved crops and not work within individual structures throughout the world. I also heard you mention you seem to be saying that the developing world was lining up against the developed world in this debate, yet we have countries like Kenya and Mexico and many West African nations, South Africa, Israel, that are currently growing biotechnology crops to help subsistence farmers, for example. In Kenya, they've developed virus-resistant cassava and sweet potatoes to help folks throughout the world. It concerns me to hear people say that there's not enough known about biotechnology. There's quite a bit known. I mean, there's over 30 years of research, government-regulated field trials, over 25,000. So you have the FDA and the EPA in this country, you have the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, the World Bank, and numerous scientific bodies in Great Britain, including the Royal Academy of Sciences and the House of Lords, that have endorsed the current applications of biotechnology. The current applications of biotech are about what we know, not about what we don't know. And there is quite a bit that we do know about biotechnology. I don't think you'd find Jimmy Carter or the Sierra Club or the Rockefeller Foundation having supported biotechnology if this were not the case.
Jay Byrne, we're also joined by Jeremy Rifkin, president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C., and author of the book The Biotech Century, Harnessing the Gene and Remaking the World. Your response to Jay Byrne, spokesperson for Monsanto?
Just a correction. I don't think the Sierra Club has come out in favor of genetically engineered organisms. I think he better go back and do his homework.
Actually,
I think the real issue here is this. The fact is, Mr. Byrne says that we have 20 years of experiments to show that this is safe, and I have to respectfully disagree. The bottom line here is we don't have a risk assessment science. A predictive ecology does not exist so that we could actually assess the risk of introducing any of these genetically engineered organisms into the environment. In chemistry, for example, we have toxicology. It's a methodology for assigning risk. It doesn't work very well, but at least it exists. There is no comparable risk assessment science here to regulate these products, and that's why it's rather Kafkaesque that companies like Monsanto are pretending that we can regulate the introduction of these organisms when they know darn well there's just no science by which to do it. Secondly, there's a liability issue here, which Monsanto really needs to come to grips with, and that is this. The major insurance companies are only insuring for short-term crop damage and negligence. They have refused to insure for long-term catastrophic losses in case any of Monsanto's genes do turn loose through gene flow and begin to fix to weedy relatives. So the real issue at Cartagena is liability. Who's going to be responsible if one of Monsanto's genes jumps during pollination, fixed to a weed, and a weed begins to reproduce, and you have a cumulative long-term effect with genetic pollution? Right now, it's an open ballgame. There is no liability fixed here whatsoever. And finally, I think we have to look at the patent question here. Monsanto has done something which, and I want to use this term carefully, which I consider evil in the sense that they have created this terminator gene. And you have to understand what this whole patent's about. When Monsanto provides a seed to a farmer, they're not selling that seed. There's no seller-buyer relationship. They are giving that farmer access to one of their patented seeds for one season. It always remains the within the purview of the supplier to control ownership and to ensure that the farmer does not use the new seeds after the harvest. Monsanto has placed a turnoff switch, what we call a terminator gene switch, in the seed so you can't replant with the new seeds. This means that for the first time in history, after thousands of years of farmers owning their own seeds, reproducing seeds, sharing seeds with neighbors, for the first time in history, a major company has blocked that process, and now every farmer in the world is going to have to go to Monsanto and Novartis and a handful of companies in order to get seeds for their very livelihood each year, and I would call that evil on a grand scale.
Well, you know, Amy, Jeremy's a very passionate critic here, and he raises some very understandable concerns. But unfortunately, the science and the facts simply don't back him up. Just right off the top, first of all, Monsanto did not create this so-called Terminator scene, which is a phrase like Frankenstein foods that's designed to scare people. We don't own it. It was created by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in cooperation with a Mississippi cottonseed company.
Well, you own the cottonseed company.
Don't tell the folks other than that. It doesn't even, the technology doesn't even exist.
Wait a minute. Are you saying you do not own that subsidiary company?
No, Monsanto's put a bid in to buy it, and that hasn't been approved.
But the bid is in.
The bid is in. And, you know, this technology that, you know, Mr. Rifkin and others have categorized as Terminator, one, as I said, it doesn't exist. It's a theory right now. It wouldn't exist for 5 to 10 years, if ever. It would have to go through all the normal regulatory reviews and processes. And there's not just a handful of seed companies. There's over 6,000 seed companies in the United States alone. Farmers choose whether or not they want to purchase these technologies.
Well, let me back up and tell you that's just incorrect. Right now, 10 life science companies in the world control and own 30% of all the valuable seed stock on this planet, and Monsanto is one of those 10 companies.
So then you have 60% of all the other valuable seed stock owned by others. 10 companies divided by 30%.
Well, how long is it going to take for those 10 companies to buy up the rest of the seed companies?
So here again we have Jeremy speculating.
I'm not speculating. I'm looking at the progression of facts here. The fact is that Monsanto is attempting to take what has been a traditional free blessing of nature, which is the seed to this earth, and control it through intellectual property, and then demand that farmers gain access to that through this company. Yeah, by what logic should Monsanto claim the seeds of this earth has its own invention.
And,
by what logic?
That's not what's happening here. Technology companies like Monsanto or Novartis or DuPont are working to improve the technology that's added to seeds, whether that's an insect resistance or something else. There's no concept of controlling the seeds themselves. If you invest billions of dollars, however, to improve something, such as providing insect resistance so you don't have to spray pesticides on plants, then you want to be able to recoup the value of the investment and make your living by doing so.
Well, first of all, the major investment in these seeds was not made by Monsanto, but countries in which these seeds were nurtured and were grown and were developed over hundreds and thousands of years. All Monsanto has done is simply tinker with a little bit of the genetic information in these seeds, enough to get a patent, and then claim its control over a seed that someone else nurtured for a long, long time. Secondly, if Monsanto is really concerned about sustainable agriculture and feeding the world, why would it attempt, one, to patent the seed, and two, to then develop with the USDA a process by which farmers could not reuse their new seeds? If your real interest is in the farmers and not in corporate greed, then how can you explain the inherent contradiction in having patents and a Terminator seed?
Jeremy, Monsanto is a company involved in business, and you know, farmers, again, choose whether or not they want to use these technologies. And
how do farmers
again,
control whether they're going to use the technologies if
here.
The seeds themselves are controlled by a handful
second,
of companies? Secondly, one of the things that I'd like to find out, and I notice you haven't mentioned it yet, last week there was some very disquieting news out of the United Kingdom that a scientific experiment where rats were fed genetically engineered potatoes. The results of the study showed that the rat's immune system broke down and the organs atrophied. And an earlier report, said that the scientist was mistaken.
Let me step in here for a minute for our listeners who are just joining us. Jeremy Rifkin is with us, who is author of the book The Biotech Century, Harnessing the Gene and Remaking the World. And Jay Byrne joins us as well, spokesperson for Monsanto Company. This as the conference in Cartagena, Colombia goes on about biosafety. Jay Byrne, would you like to respond to Jeremy Rifkin on this study that came out of Britain saying that rats who were fed bioengineered foods were hurt? In fact, I understand that there's a memorandum written by 22 scientists from 16 countries, which concluded that genetically engineered foods might have severe health risks. And it lent support to the scientist in Aberdeen, Scotland, who announced his concern about genetically engineered foods after he conducted these tests on lab rats.
Because we sent you the materials on this, Dr. Pustai with the Rowett Institute in Aberdeen, it turned out, actually, he did not feed rats genetically modified foods. He fed them potatoes injected with a well-known toxic bean lectin, and then the rats developed problems based on that. The Institute, in fact, disavowed the findings. Several independent organizations, including the Royal Academy of Sciences, et cetera, looked at this and said, well, in fact, one, there is no genetically modified food on the market today that would include a known toxic, such as a bean lectin, that was known to have toxic qualities. And two, in fact, the science was not about genetically modified foods. He took the actual lectin directly from the bean, injected it into a regular potato, and fed that to rats. You can create lab tests after experiment to demonstrate something wrong with
that's
a certain
exactly
application, but that's done to prove that there's certain things you shouldn't do in biotechnology.
Well, listen, this is just plain old obfuscation. If you take a look at the reports coming out of the United Kingdom, it's very obvious that there's a problem here. When you place a gene from a non-related food source into the human diet, as we're doing with these transgenic genes,
but
there's absolutely no way of knowing whether there'll be an allergenic effect because we have no evolutionary history with these non-food-related gene sources. The second thing that interests me about Mr. Burns and his apologies for the company is this. For years, Monsanto has argued, well, genetic pollution is not a possibility, that genes cannot flow to wild, reedy relatives. And now, in the last year, we have the Danish government study and now the University of Chicago study, which shows that if you place a herbicide-tolerant gene or a pest-resistant gene into a transgenic crop like Monsanto's doing, those genes will easily flow during pollination. And if there are wild relatives or weedy relatives in the vicinity, they can fix those genes to their code, and then you have weeds and wild relatives that are fixing for herbicide tolerance, for pest resistance, for viral resistance. Who's going to be liable? How do you clean that up? This is a form of pollution that reproduces, that mutates, that proliferates, and nobody's dealing with the issues of long-term liability. I'd like to know, is Monsanto prepared to pay for the long-term cumulative potential losses if genes flow, transgenic genes, to wild relatives and stay for a long period of time in the natural environment? Are you prepared to cover the liability for a whole ecosystem?
You know, again, Jeremy is relying on opinion and not fact. The fact is...
That's the opinion. That's not opinion. The Danish government study and the University of Chicago study were peer-reviewed. They were in scientific journals. They were released to the public. Yeah. That's not opinion. That's science.
What you're trying to state is that where they've identified the fact that such issues as cross-pollination can occur, they occur rarely, they don't occur uniformly, and that there are things put into place, such as creating refuge areas.
Oh, give me a break. You're telling the public here that a refuge area is going to stop a gene from flowing during pollination? That's absurd.
You know,
absolutely. From an ecological point of view and a biological point of view,
that
is just pure bunkum.
All of these organizations have looked at this, and they all disagree with Mr. Rifkin.
Gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt for a minute because I want to end on the point we started with Jay Byrne, and that was the story of Percy Schmeiser, who is the farmer in Canada who had Pinkerton detectives come onto his land to investigate whether he was using Monsanto seeds. He said he hadn't used them and that somehow something must have cross-pollinated from another field. Is this what the tactic of Monsanto is now, sending in Pinkerton detectives to farmers' fields?
This is a perfect example to demonstrate that, in fact, outcrossing does not occur uniformly. Unfortunately, in Mr. Schmeiser's case, he has over 900 acres of soybeans. And somehow he's claiming that magically a technology trait has appeared in every single plant on his 900 acres of land. This is simply a case where a farmer chose to use a technology that he hadn't paid for, and he puts his neighbors at a competitive disadvantage. He's essentially stealing from the company that tries to sell the technology.
And you know what? I would say the company is stealing from the evolutionary legacy of thousands of years of growing these crops and these foods for the human race. But it is shameful, absolutely shameful, that a company like Monsanto is claiming the genetic legacy, the germplasm, the food crops of thousands of years as your intellectual property simply because you tampered with a slight bit of genetic information in the laboratory and convinced the government to give you a patent. That's shameful.
You know, Jeremy, if a company is able to find a way to eliminate the use of pesticides in the field through billions of dollars of research so that we can grow crops.
This is more pesticides because
on that note, we have to end, but I do want to get a yes or no answer. Does Monsanto hire Pinkerton detectives to investigate the seeds farmers are using?
Monsanto does use, in some extreme cases, investigators when there have been reports that farmers have used technology outside of the agreements that they made with the company.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Jay Byrne of Monsanto and Jeremy Rifkin. He's author of the book Biotech Century. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Watch the rape of the world.